Welcome to the Freedom Formula for Physicians podcast, where it's all about slashing your debt and taxes and creating a liberated lifestyle. And now, your host, with a love of fantasy books and funk, and a hatred of running more than 3 miles, Dave Denniston.
My name is Dave Denniston, your host, and welcome back to the latest episode of the Freedom Formula for Physicians podcast. Well, welcome back, my friends, to our monthly fireside chat with a physician to get to know their journey, their joys, and their struggles with finances and outside of finances. This show is not always about actionable content. It is, however, a chance for you to see behind the curtains, to walk in another person's shoes, and to experience their lives. Well, our next guest, he has not only been a physician, he's also a financial blogger and a thought leader. And as a matter of fact, he has inspired over a dozen physicians to start their own blog so that they could model his success. Now, a little bio on him. He is a practicing full-time board-certified emergency physician that is just a few years out of residency. Although he's always been interested in personal finance and investing, he has just recently started diving into this field as a resident when he finally got sick of so many financial professionals ripping him off. And in fact, most of his first few financial encounters with financial professionals ended badly for him. So that sucks, and I know many of us can relate to that, and unfortunately, doctors are a target. So we'll dive into that a little bit later. But I know he has a ton of wisdom to share with us, and with no further ado, please help me welcome Dr. Jim Dolley, the White Coat Investor. Welcome, Jim.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
Well, Jim, I am so glad that you are with us to share with us your wisdom and your journey. Now, I know it's been quite a ride with you so far with this side hustle that you've had going. And I've heard financial knowledge, it wasn't always something that was important to you. However, before we get going to that, take a step back with us to the past. Let's step in with you for a moment. First, tell us more about you. Where'd you grow up and what was your childhood like?
Well, I actually grew up in Alaska. In Anchorage. I spent the first 18 years of my life there, almost never left the state. I'm one of 6 kids. I'm the third one, and had a fairly ideal childhood. My parents stayed together. My mother was a stay-at-home mom. My dad was an engineer and a bush pilot on the side. And we grew up in a beautiful place with a lot of roots, surrounded by a lot of really good people. Anchorage is a town of about 300,000, so it's big enough to have one of everything. The other Alaskans joke that Anchorage is just 10 minutes from Alaska, but it turned out to be a really great place to grow up for me.
Now, is that a place that there's a lot of outdoor activities? I've personally never been to Alaska. I'm sure that it's a place that a lot of our listeners haven't been either. So is this a very community-oriented place? How would you describe it?
Well, Alaska is one of those places where you either leave after the first winter or you stay for the rest of your life. It's a very unique place. And if you don't like the things that are unique about it, if they aren't huge positives for you, the rather huge negatives of living in the state will drive you out pretty quickly. You know, it's cold and it's dark and it's very isolated. It's expensive to go anywhere else. You know, there aren't any road trips to Vegas. But in return for that, the summers are just bliss. The sun's up all the time. The temperatures are perfect. You know, you have gorgeous mountains rising out of the sea and glaciers calving and all kinds of wildlife. And it's really a beautiful place. But if you're not into outdoor activity, you know, you can see why it wouldn't be a lot of fun. In fact, not only do you need an outdoor activity, you need one you can do in the winter because the winter's long, you know, whether that's riding a snowmobile or whether that's ice fishing or ice climbing or whatever it might be. But you've got to learn to enjoy something outside in the winter. You'll just go nuts up there.
Yeah, I bet. Well, it really strikes me when I listen to you that this sounds like the kind of place that in itself, it's probably not too expensive to live there. You have all this outdoor stuff. Is that a fair assessment?
Well, I mean, everything's a little more expensive. It's kind of like Hawaii that way. It's got to be flown in. And so the cost of living is actually fairly high, but in general, people get paid a little bit more to live up there. And so they usually, you know, it works out even. It's not Manhattan, but it certainly isn't Indianapolis.
Yeah, I can see that. With everything being so far away in Alaska. Well, in this podcast, we focus on finances, and it's just so fascinating to me to see what's shaped and molded perceptions around money. Now, what about for you, Jim? What's been some of your biggest influences related to money?
Well, I don't know that I had a lot of influence related to money when I was growing up. I mean, I think the only real influence you get is from your parents, your parents' example. And, you know, my parents, my dad was working for the state, and so he had a pension coming to him, and that was the main form of retirement he expected from the job that he had the whole time I was at school. And so I don't know that there was a ton of retirement savings going on. I do remember one time when we were out of money, they sat us down and told us, but that was, you know, for a couple of weeks until the next paycheck came in. You know, we never went hungry or anything like that. We lived in a, I think the house was 2,200 square feet in a nice neighborhood, going to nice schools. So I certainly didn't suffer in any way. It was a middle class to maybe slightly upper middle class lifestyle, despite having six kids in the house. But I don't know that I had huge influences with regard to money at that stage in my life. Maybe a bigger influence was when I left to college. And we knew the deal that we were, you know, expected and encouraged to go to college, but there wasn't much help coming from our parents. They'd fly us home for the holidays and for the summer, and that was about it. And so my siblings and I, we either worked to pay for school, or we got scholarships, or we took out student loans. But, you know, I think most of the influences for all of us as far as money come from those few years when we were basically on our own without much of an income. I think that had a much greater influence on me as far as my financial habits.
Well, it sounds like, and let me know if I captured this right, that learning about money, it wasn't something that was a regular part of your life. It really sounds like that you learned a lot once you started earning money, but it wasn't something that came easily in your family. So you had to learn a lot about money as you went along.
That's exactly right. I mean, there really wasn't any, you know, conversations about money with my parents by any means. But you know, there's nothing quite like the school of hard knocks, and I certainly learned a lot as soon as I got out of the house. Really didn't have much interest, however, in finance or investing, even all the way into medical school. It just wasn't something that was very interesting to me. I was always interested, you know, like most doctors, I was interested in science. And so that's what I majored in college, and that's what I focused on, and I didn't even pay any attention to any of my, you know, roommates that had more interest in business, which in retrospect, maybe I should have gotten a little bit more formal training because I ended up having to teach myself a lot of that later.
Well, here you are in medicine now. As you grew up, did you know you always wanted to be in medicine? How did that start for you?
You know, you take those surveys in junior high of what career you think would be good for you. And, you know, no surprise, medicine was on the list for me. But I don't think I actually committed to it until my third year of college. And I can remember a conversation on the phone with my dad saying, you know, if I go to medical school, I'm going to be 31 before I ever get out of training. And he told me, you're going to be 31, you know, at that point in time, whether you go into medical school and residency or not. You know, he just had the perspective that 31 was a very young age, not an old age. And at the time for me, I think I was 22 or 23, 31 just seemed older than dirt. And so he really gave me some perspective. And that was when I committed to it, just in time to, you know, study for the MCAT and apply to medical school.
So now you're in the place, you've gone to medical school, you're going through residency. And I think in your case, you're in the military of some sort?
Well, I had the way the military scholarship that I went to school on works is you basically sign up and become a commissioned officer at the start of medical school. And then you go to medical school and they give you a stipend each month and pay all your tuition and fees. And then at the end of medical school, you got to go through the military match. And most of the time you end up being matched into a military residency. Then after your residency, you owe them a year for a year that they paid for medical school. So if they paid for 3 years, you owe them 3 years. If they paid for 4 years, you owe them 4 years. And so that's, you know, that's how I paid for medical school. in retrospect, you know, it's a debt one way or the other, whether it's time or money. You know, I actually ran the numbers once on it, and the military got me for quite a good deal.
So what do you think? Was it 4 years, including undergrad, and then medical school afterwards? What was that?
No, they paid for 4 years of medical school. I paid for undergraduate by working my way through, for the most part, as well as a tuition scholarship that I had. I had a very, very small student loan from my first year of undergraduate. It was about $5,000. But, you know, when I tell medical students about the terms of that loan, they can't believe it. It was such a great loan. But, you know, it's not available anymore.
Well, back then, you could shop around a whole bunch of different companies easily during your undergrad.
Well, this one was even better. It was from the state of Alaska, and they allowed you to defer the interest while you were an undergraduate, a medical student, a resident, and in the military. So I ended up paying it back 17 years later without having ever paid interest on it. So it was, you know, a rather good deal for a loan. But I don't think the state of Alaska is doing that anymore.
Well, I'm sure they learned their lesson.
That's right. I basically borrowed $5,000 and paid back $3,000 once you look at the effects of inflation.
Well, it sounds like from your side that you paid with time rather than money. And so debt wasn't really a big part of your journey. But outside of medical school debt, was there ever a time that you just struggled with any sort of credit card debt as you went along in your journey? Or were you just paying for everything in cash? What was that like for you?
Well, I mean, first of all, I think there's this misperception that whether it's military service or Indian Health Service or whatever, that there's no debt there and that it must be a great idea. And I don't think that's necessarily true. I mean, in many ways, I did have a debt. I had no choice whatsoever about my job when I came out of residency. I had no choice about where I was going to live or about what I was going to do or how many shifts a month I was going to work or what continent I was going to be practicing on. And so in many ways, my debt was a time debt, not a money debt. And, you know, as I look back on it, especially because I went to the University of Utah when tuition really wasn't very expensive, I probably could have been out of debt within a year coming out of residency. But instead, I basically owed 4 years of time. And so, you know, I certainly was affected a great deal. My career had a great effect on it because of that debt. Now, the military wasn't all bad. There were a lot of good things about it. But there certainly was some debt involved. You know, as an undergraduate, I wasn't living on very much money. You know, I had either three or five roommates the whole way through and was donating plasma for food money. You know, I was barely scraping by. My transportation was a bicycle, and, you know, I'd bust my butt all summer to make as much money as I could. Then I'd divide it by eight, and that's what I had to live on for the rest of the year until I could, you know, get a summer job again. And so I think that period of time, those years of my life, really taught me to live on very little and realize that, you know, you don't need a lot in order to get by. And so I think they were pretty formative financially for me. But I remember at the end of it, one of the reasons that I signed up with the military is I was sick of being dirt poor. And they were offering me $900 a month as a stipend, and that just seemed like a ton. And so I was excited to sign up with them for that reason.
Hmm. So it really sounds like that time, I'm just thinking back to, you were back with your parents in that 1 or 2 weeks where you had no money. And there was that influence of feeling like you were dirt poor. It sounds like that's just really impacted your life. And as you started to be smart with money, that you had that in the back of your mind, and you had no credit card debt through this whole process. You were making it on a meager income.
That's correct. I never even really considered borrowing at that point in life. You know, I basically looked at, well, here's what I'm making, here's what I'll spend. I'm not sure whether that was just kind of my overall, you know, anti-debt feeling or why I lived like that, but, you know, that's the way it was.
Well, for people that maybe didn't grow up that way, there's a lot of physicians that are listening to us right now, and that perhaps they came from a solid, great family, and they're not used to having to live on meager means and living like a resident, as we hear it said. And I hear it's a lot harder for us to step down our living expenses, and it's, in the comparison, easy just to step them up. And I want to talk about that for a little bit. How different people are brought up and how some physicians really just struggle in that process.
Yeah, it's difficult sometimes to look at how other people are brought up and understand them that way, but there's no doubt that those early influences can affect us and how we end up living our lives. I think it's hard for people to learn to be really frugal if they've never been forced to do it. In fact, I worry a little bit about my kids that way and try to teach them as we go along, just because they're really never going to struggle for money like I did. And so it's almost, you artificially have to create that a little bit. For example, I was at the store with my son last night and he wanted to buy a rubber band gun, but he hadn't brought his wallet. You know, he had the $16 it was going to cost, but he had it at home. He wanted to borrow from me so that he could buy the rubber band gun last night rather than having to go back to the store later. And I told him I wouldn't loan it to him. Now, obviously, I've got $16, but I'm trying to teach him a lesson there. And I don't know how well that works to teach that sort of thing artificially, but I'm sure trying.
Now, one of the things that I heard from another podcast guest, Glenn Livingston, he talked about the habit of work, that getting used to working is something that he has seen working for a lot of people, a lot of families, that working kids early, having to actually earn money, seems to have a strong correlation to an appreciation of that money. How about you? Do you agree with that?
I think that's absolutely true. You know, I'm constantly quizzing my kids, where does money come from? And they'll answer, it comes from work. You know, they got that one down. There's no doubt about it. You know, I like to think of myself as a little bit inherently lazy. And I bet if you ask my parents, they'll say the same thing. So I'm not sure exactly where I learned to work so hard. But it must have been at some point as an undergraduate.
Now, outside of debt, which is something that you talk about and I talk about a ton on the podcast, when you think of preparing for retirement, what sort of problems are costing physicians, your friends, your colleagues, the most money right now?
Well, I think there's a few things. One is their lifestyle. They're simply spending too much. You know, in that regard, doctors aren't any different from any other American. You know, the savings rates are fairly atrocious. People start celebrating that they're positive, you know, or that they hit 4 or 5%. But in reality, most doctors need to be saving something like 20% of their income just for retirement. And so that's probably the main issue, is they just spend too much and don't save enough. Another issue for physicians is they tend to be targeted by the financial industry and maybe get hit with higher fees than maybe some other people do. And so a lot of their money goes out in investing expenses as well as taxes. And so those are, I think, the really big opponents that physicians have when it comes to building wealth. It's their own desire to spend, the fact that they're highly taxed, and the fact that the financial industry preys on them a bit with high fees.
Now, speaking of high fees, and in full disclosure, you are the White Coat Investor, and I was a former advertiser on this site. But, dude, it got too expensive as your site blew up.
That's, you know, it's one of those things that we looked at and we said, well, we've got people knocking down our door to advertise, and I'm not sure how to choose who we should as an advertiser other than to raise prices until we see who it's worth it to stick around. And so I'm sorry about that, but unfortunately, that's the reality of a business like this.
Well, hey, it's capitalism, right? And I don't want to pay that much.
That's
it's
right.
Up to me. But anyhow, you know, one of the biggest forms of flattery is imitation. And it's one of the things I really want to touch on here. You have inspired many physicians to start a side hustle, a blog, a podcast, and they're looking to your success and they want to do it too. They want to do what you're doing. So for those that are thinking about it, maybe those that are already doing it, what do you think are the biggest keys to success that you've had with your blog?
Well, I think the biggest, there are a few keys to success. Number one, it helps that I was first. You know, I saw a big need in that docs just weren't getting this information, and I could see this huge niche that was completely unfilled. And so I stepped into you know, a pond that basically didn't have any other predators in it. And so that made it really easy in the beginning because I was, you know, basically the first one in there. But the thing that really made a difference, I think, was the sense of mission. You know, the mission of the website was to help docs get a fair shake on Wall Street, you know, help those who wear the white coat get a fair shake. And that really was the reason why I did it. You know, I didn't make any money that first year. I think I made $936 and I wrote it all off. And even the second year, I only made something like 5 grand. So as a business, you know, I was spending way more time than I was getting paid for. There was no doubt about it. And I had no idea that it was ever going to do so well financially. And so while I started it as a business from day one, and I wanted to learn about, you know, earning passive income and that sort of thing, what really drove me to do it and what really kept me going and putting in all those hours was that I really wanted to help other people, other docs and similar high-income professionals get a fair shake. And so I think without that sense of mission, if the goal is just to have a side hustle, just make a little money on the side, you know, I've seen a lot of blogs come and go that are trying to do the same thing. And they realize that, you know, you really got to have a passion for this stuff for it to last long enough to start making any money.
Well, I think more than anything, Jim, I mean, for me, it's these conversations that you have with your audience. It's like people feel like you have all this awesome knowledge to bring, that you are maybe bringing some entertainment. But more than anything, your audience is feeling heard. They feel like they know you. They know that you're going to listen to them. And maybe they even want you to manage their money, because you know their problems and know what they're going through. And I think to me that that's a huge key to success in blogs and podcasts. And frankly, I hope I'm touching on this same kind of feeling for folks. And maybe there's someone listening right now, and they haven't had much of a business education. So I'd like to let them behind the curtain a little bit to understand the business side of running a blog or a podcast. Now, I know both you and I, we follow Pat Flynn's Smart Passive Income podcast and John Lee Dumas's Eon Fire, and those guys publish income reports every month. As a matter of fact, I encourage everyone, check those out. You know, learn how this stuff works, how money is made. And I think there's a stark difference between those two, and maybe even between what you're doing and what they're doing. And when I checked out Pat's podcast, he is doing a ton of affiliate deals. The huge, vast part of his income is through affiliate income, which honestly, I was pretty shocked by. Now, in comparison, John Lee Dumas of Eon Fire seems to make most of his money through self-produced information products or SaaS, which is software as a service. My perception is that in your case, the majority of income from your blog is through advertising. Now, I don't know if that's true or not, but I'd like you to tell us a little bit about these business models. What is an affiliate, for those who may not know? And why have you set up the blog financially the way that you have?
Well, I mean, it's set up, you know, business-wise the way it is because that's what seems to work for me. I mean, it's purely an empirical and practical decision. Whatever seemed to bring in the most money, that's what we did. And if we found something that was better, we swapped it out. And so, you know, the model we use, we, you know, gradually worked our way to over the course of 2 or 3 or 4 years. And, you know, and we're constantly searching for new lines of revenue. And so, you know, as a business, it's, you know, it's hard to say what someone else ought to do because a different model might work for them. If you're in a different niche or if you're trying to do something, you know, similar, you know, you may use a totally different business model and find success with it and not find success with my business model. So I wouldn't necessarily say you have to do exactly what I'm doing. There's a lot of different ways to make money on the internet. In many ways, the internet is the wild west of entrepreneurship. You know, just about anything goes. And if it doesn't go, you can change your business to another country and it'll go there, you know. And so you can really do anything you want and you're really only limited by your own morals. The way we're set up right now is we have some affiliate income. And we have some direct advertising, and we use some ad serving from like Google AdSense. And then we get some things like book royalties coming in and fees for writing for other publications and fees for speaking gigs and that sort of thing. And so there's a lot of various sources of revenue that come into the site. I guess if I had to look at the big sources, it's about a quarter affiliate income, about a half direct ad sales, and the other quarter is mostly book royalties. The book continues to sell month after month after month, which has really been probably the best source of a passive income at this point that I've ever had. And I've been amazed because most books, you know, the sales numbers go down over the first 6 months and then continue to plummet after that. But in reality, I was selling more books a year after publication than I was the first month of publication. And so that's been really pleasing to see that book continue to sell.
So tell us about the book a little bit. What is the book about? What's in it? And what can people expect to see?
Sure. The book has the same title as the website. It's called The White Coat Investor. It's a doctor's guide to personal finance and investing. And the book, I was encouraged to write the book by blog readers. They said, you ought to just, you know, package some of this stuff on the blog up and put it in a book. And I wish I'd done it 2 years earlier now that I've seen how well it sells. But partly the reason the book is so successful is I include a lot of my own personal story in it. You know, I talk about how we basically became millionaires 7 years out of residency and how what we did really isn't that difficult. You know, it didn't involve any startups or anything difficult. All we did was carve out a big chunk of our income and invest it in boring investments. And so people find that inspiring, the fact that they get a look into, you know, behind the curtain of our lives, because so few physicians even talk about money. To actually get one that will share with you their financial life, I think means a lot. And then the remainder of the book mostly takes people stage by stage through their medical career and talks about how they can optimize their finances. And so I think people find that to be really helpful. It takes a lot of the information on the blog and puts it into a very readable format so you can kind of catch up to the long-term readers all at once. Another reason why that book is so successful, though, has little to do with me and everything to do with the blog readers. After I wrote that book, I sent it out to about 20 readers and got a ton of feedback. I basically ended up rewriting the whole book, making it about a third longer, and it's a dramatically better book than the original one I wrote. And so in many ways, it's kind of a crowdsourced book. It's got stories from other people in it. It has tons of improvements that were suggestions from regular blog readers. And I think that made a big difference in having, you know, a quality product out there, despite it being self-published.
Now, I want to point this out, and I want to emphasize to everyone that is thinking about having some sort of product. Pat Flynn of Smart Passive Income talks about testing. And as you think about online businesses doing micro-testing, what Jim set up here, setting up 20 of his readers out there to improve it, and it made it so much better of a product. I am guessing that, Jim, maybe you're even testing posts or things like that.
You know, I should do more testing, to be honest with you. There's a lot of things I could do to try to optimize the revenue from the site. But every time I only have a limited amount of time. And when I look at the main mission of the site, it's to get this information to as many people as I can. And so that's where I try to spend my time rather than trying to tweak every dollar out of my current business model. If you just, provide as much value as you can to as many people as you can reach, the money seems to come after it, no matter how well you're optimized. Maybe someday I can spend more time trying to, A/B test and do that sort of thing to try to see what's the very best way to send out emails and the best way to write a post. But for now, I just concentrate on helping as many people as I can.
All right. Well, let's take a pause here for a second and go to our commercial break. Well, if you are like some members of my audience, you are committed to being an amazing doctor and succeeding at life. But the truth is, you never receive financial training during medical school, and you struggle with enough time to do it all. Well, my friends, I am committed to increasing your financial knowledge and all this jargon you may hear tossed around. I am committed to helping guide you through this confusing maze of financial decisions that you know you need to make. paying off debt, reducing taxes, saving for college, and so much more. And that's why this month I have a special offer for you. You can pick up my book, The Freedom Formula for Physicians, for only a dollar. That's right, the whole copy, a physical copy, for only a dollar. You can visit the podcast website now at www.drfreedompodcast.com/dollar, D-O-L-L-A-R, to pick up your copy. I simply ask you help to pick up the cost of shipping it to you. So don't let this podcast be like other ones where you hear great information, you get these new ideas, but you never actually complete anything. To snag your copy now, visit www.drfreedompodcast.com/dollar. Again, that's www.drfreedompodcast.com/dollar. So with all this that you have going on, and I've heard you on a number of different interviews, one thing I've never heard you talk about is the fact that many physicians, and you being one of them, have to pay Uncle Sam more and more and more. Can you share with us for a moment, how have taxes been part of this journey for you? And what have you been doing to help get your taxes lower?
Well, I think taxes are a big issue for most docs. And the reason why is their income tends to be compressed into a relatively few number of years. You know, it's a high income, but you may not start getting it until you're 35. And so, you know, with our progressive tax system, you can lose an awful lot of what you earn to taxes, especially if you're not doing all you can to lower those taxes. Probably the biggest tax break I enjoy is tax-deferred retirement accounts. And it's nice that I've not only got a good plan with my medical partnership, you know, we have a 401k profit-sharing plan that I can put $53,000 a year into. We also have a defined benefit cash balance plan, which allows me to shield another $30,000. In addition to that, my wife and I both work here at the White Coat Investor, and we have an individual 401k here, which allows us each to shelter another $53,000 a year. And so that is a huge tax break, to be able to take that off the top of our earned income and not only save it for retirement and protect it from creditors, but just to not pay taxes on it. And that, so that saves us a ton of money on our taxes. That's a big thing. Another big thing is just to realize how the tax code works. You know, I spent some time early in my career reading books and learning about the tax code and doing my own taxes just to get a sense of what the rules are and what Uncle Sam wants to subsidize in my life. And by living your life in accordance with what Uncle Sam wants, you can knock quite a bit of money off your tax bill as well. And so I think taxes are important, and there's a lot of things that physicians can do to decrease their tax burden, but for the most part, those aren't accounting tricks. They require you to live your financial life differently. But if you do so, the tax rewards are significant.
All right. Well, it sounds like six figures you've been able to sock away. You've been blessed in this position to do that. And obviously, you're not having to pay taxes on that today. But what do you make of the Roth versus traditional IRA argument?
Well, I mean, as far as IRAs go, there's no argument at all, because the only option is a backdoor Roth IRA for the typical attending physician. You know, they can't deduct a traditional IRA contribution, and they can't make a direct Roth IRA contribution. So the only thing they're really comparing is either using a taxable account or using a backdoor Roth IRA. So that issue's, you know, a non-issue for most docs, as long as you don't have some huge IRA out there sitting around preventing you from doing a backdoor Roth IRA due to the pro rata rule. You know, a backdoor Roth IRA is the way to go. On a more general topic of tax deferred contributions versus Roth contributions, such as in a 401k, it's a little bit more of a nuanced decision. But in general, if you're in your low-income years, such as being a resident or doing some military service, or a year where you have a sabbatical, or if you're part-time or in early retirement before you start getting Social Security, those are the years to be doing Roth contributions and Roth conversions, even in 401ks. But for the most part, during your peak earnings years, it's all about the tax-deferred contributions. And in fact, the less you save, the larger the benefit you will see from a tax-deferred contribution.
So I think what's an interesting choice nowadays is once you hit 70 and a half, you have to take out a required minimum distribution. And then when you have a ton of money that you took a tax deduction for, whether it's an IRA or 401k or cash balance plan, you have to start taking money out of that. And what I think is a lot of physicians may not realize is that the more and more money you put away there to get a tax deduction today, you are going to have to, you're literally going to have to take out that money later versus the Roth that will come out tax-free. And it might make more sense to folks to put away more money in a Roth 401k than a traditional 401k. What do you think about that?
Well, I think that's a wonderful problem to have. I hope all doctors end up with that problem. A much more common problem is doctors just haven't saved enough. When I talk to doctors in their 50s and 60s and about the size of their tax-deferred accounts, you know, at that point, most of them have rolled all their 401ks into an IRA, and they're doing well if they've got a $1 or $2 million IRA. You know, the required minimum distribution at age 70 is less than 4%. So if you only have a $1 or $2 million IRA, that's only $40,000 to $80,000 in taxable income. That certainly isn't going to push anybody into the highest brackets. And so for you to have a required minimum distribution problem, you've got to be a super saver for your whole career. And we're talking about getting your IRA to the 5 to 10 to 15 million size. And for the most part, people just don't save enough. Their plans don't allow them to save enough, and they don't enjoy good enough of returns to really have an issue where they're being pushed into higher brackets in retirement than they are during their main career. And if you're such a super saver that's going to become an issue for you, then sure, do some Roth 401k contributions along the way. But when people really understand just how much of an RMD they have to have to push them into the brackets they were in their working years, it just becomes a non-issue for the vast majority of high-income professionals. They simply haven't saved enough money to have that problem.
Yeah, well, I think that is a great point. And I think it takes us back to the beginning. So how is your lifestyle? How are you, my dear listeners, structuring that? For example, do you want to work longer to maintain a lifestyle? Or do you want to save more now and sacrifice now to retire at an earlier age? Well, for you, Jim, obviously you have enough that you could retire if you wanted to. You could step away from medicine if you wanted to. Now, let me just say for me personally that you have inspired me. I mean, to find the time to be a practicing physician and running this blog, that's like two full-time jobs, and that just blows my mind. It amazes me. You are doing something really special. So from the bottom of my heart, just thank you. Thank you for all you're doing, Jim. And tell us a little bit more about the blog and your future plans.
Sure. I mean, we're always trying to innovate and come up with new things. I'm bringing the book out in audiobook format here in the next month or so. And so that's really exciting thing to do. Also have plans for a couple of new books. I was able to cut back my clinical time from full-time to three-quarter time about a month ago. And so I'm hoping that'll free up some time to write those books that I currently just have in sketch format. And so that'll be another great addition, I think, to what's available out there for docs. But for the most part, I continue to just try to get the basic message of the white coat investor, you know, which is one of increasing financial literacy among physicians, out to as many people as I can. You know, it's interesting, you talk about these other blogs, some of them are kind of Me Too blogs and are trying to do something similar to what I'm doing, and people think that's competition for me. But in reality, they're helping to fulfill my mission, which is to increase the financial literacy among doctors. And so in many ways, they're helping me to do my work, so I'm very grateful for that. If more people want to copy what I'm doing, that would be wonderful.
So you're kind of like the godfather of physician blogging. So you can start acting like Marlon Brando.
That's right. I'm going to have to start icing people, I guess.
Well, you have been at this for a while, right? You have a ton of blog posts. So if someone is brand new to your blog, they've just wandered onto the web, they're looking at your website right now. Obviously, you have been at this for a number of years. You have a ton of posts. What are some of the best posts that you think that folks should check out?
Well, I've got a section on there called Classics. And so you can go on there and, just on the home page, and there'll be a list of classic posts. And I think those are the ones that have maybe affected people the most over the years. For example, I have a 5-part post on the myths of whole life insurance. It seems that every doctor either already owns one or has been had one propositioned to them. And the guys who sell them, boy, they work hard trying to get you to buy a whole life insurance policy. And so it's a chance for docs to understand what's going on behind the scenes, how the policy really works, and maybe the methods used by the insurance agents to sell them to them. And so I think that helps a lot of people out to really understand that particular product. Other posts that are pretty popular include my backdoor Roth IRA tutorial. You know, a lot of people have heard the name but aren't really sure how to do it. And this will take you step by step, including the tax form, how to fill it out, to actually do a backdoor Roth IRA. Another popular post is about the rules for a multiple 401ks. A lot of doctors don't realize that they can have more than one 401k if they have unrelated employers. And so that's also a very popular post on the site. My annual tax reports, where I talk about how much I'm paying in taxes for some reason, are also really popular. I'm not entirely sure why, but people really like having a glimpse behind the curtains there.
Well, thank you so much for sharing that. And as we wrap up this interview, I'd like you to ponder this question for a moment. Let's take a step back into the past. You're not a practicing physician. You're not even a resident. You're in medical school. If you could sit down with a younger Jim, a Jim that's about to finish medical school, what advice would you give to him?
You know, it's interesting. I don't have a lot of regrets from that period of life. You know, I'm still very grateful for the specialty I chose. I'm grateful for the residency I went to. At that point, I was already committed to the military. I may have done that a little bit differently. But I think the main thing would be to maybe point out to them that your priorities in 10 or 15 years are going to be very different from what they are as a medical student. You're going to care a little bit more about your lifestyle. You're going to care a little bit more about your income. Your idea of what you want your life to look like is going to be very different. And I think that's probably going to be the case 10 or 15 years from now for me. And so it's a fun journey as you go through life and realize that your priorities and your goals and your ambitions gradually change. For instance, I never would have imagined I would have been spending so much time doing something like the white coat investor back in medical school.
Great advice. Well, there's so much more on physicians that we simply don't have time to cover. Do you have any closing thoughts that you think folks should be aware of?
I think people really need to concentrate on what their financial situation can do for them. In many ways, getting a handle on your finances can increase your happiness. But that's only up to a certain point. Beyond that point, you know, more money isn't going to make you any more happy. Lowering your taxes a little further isn't going to make you any more happy. But in the beginning, those activities are very high yield, not only for improving your financial situation, but for decreasing your stress and increasing your happiness. And so if you haven't taken those beginning steps to get a handle on your financial situation and really feel like you've got a plan for your financial future, do it as soon as you can. It really can make a dramatic difference in your personal life, in your career, and obviously in your finances.
Well, thanks so much for being with us, Jim. If people have more questions, how can they get in contact with you?
The easiest way to find me is just through the website. There's a contact me page on whitecoatinvestor.com. I also take emails at editor@whitecoatinvestor.com.
Well, thanks again, my friends, for being with us, and I would love to tell your story. It would be my honor to host you on the next podcast. I know there's so much we can learn from your journey, and it will help other doctors. After all, who better to speak to physicians than another physician? I think there's going to be some awesome stuff that Jim laid out here for us today. Well, make sure to contact me, Dave, at drfreedompodcast.com or on my website, www.drfreedompodcast.com. For the Freedom Formula for Physicians podcast, this is Dave Denniston. Remember, my friends, remember to slash your debt, slash your taxes, live a liberated lifestyle. Also, if you gain some value out of this podcast, I would be eternally grateful if you could take 5 minutes, review it on iTunes or on Google Play. The reviews help more and more physicians become aware of this podcast. Well, thanks so much for joining us. Make sure to subscribe. Check in again soon. Have a good one. Hey, this is Dave Denniston. I hope you liked today's episode. If you do and you want some more ideas on achieving financial freedom, I am personally committed to increasing your financial knowledge. And we've talked today about a bunch of jargon. You may hear it tossed around. And so this month, my friends, I have a very special offer for you. You can pick up my book, The Freedom Formula for Physicians, for only $1. That's right, the whole copy, a whole physical copy you can hold in your hands for only $1. You can visit the podcast website now at www.drfreedompodcast.com/dollar to pick up your copy. And my friends, I simply ask you help to pick up the cost of shipping for sending it to you. So don't let this podcast be like other ones where you hear great information, you get out new ideas, but you never actually complete anything. To snag your copy now, visit www.drfreedompodcast.com/dollar. Again, that's www.drfreedompodcast.com/dollar.